you have no idea. You just get on with, you know, making your coffee and getting on with your experiments and doing your stuff. You have no idea where over the earth you are unless you actually go look out of the window. And usually when you go look out of the window, you see clouds. So it takes a bit of getting used to it. Yeah? Well, four experiments. The first was a protein crystallization, so it took some testing here on the Earth. Is very comparable for guys in space. There's no sort of surprise effects over there. It was a muscle development test, so basically looking at, kind of technical, looking at training the muscles using relaxation actions. So most exercises train your muscles by pulling, but there's a lot of interesting research going on at looking at the training of muscles. I didn't ask George Bush's permission. We took sheep and mice, stem cells from sheep and mice, and embryos from sheep and mice, and cultured those basically from the day before launch, right through a 10-day flight, and then froze them immediately on landing. Yeah?
What things did you sort of go...
Some great shots, and the NASA guys let me borrow one of their cameras. I wish I'd taken Debian, but The Russians just looked at me strangely and insisted that that I take was WinXP. But I did take Mozilla and OpenOffice. Those were the tools that we used. Yeah. Then safety. But one of the bonuses of that is that you then get to stuff your suit full of all the illegal contraband that you're going to take up to space. So we kind of then get out of the bus and kind of make our way up to the gantry that way. So you're supposed to take, it's like 1.8 kilos we were allowed, plus about another 1.5 inside your suit of extra bits and pieces. 150 people when it went up. In those days, they used to sort of set out deck chairs and all stand around the, you know, sit around the launch, and it literally killed its entire design bureau because from the general on down, because they had a catastrophic failure on the launch pad.
Are there similarities between that and
Nurga? No, a totally different design. So the N1 is like a scaled-up Soyuz. You just take principle that they have one main liquid fuel launcher and then up to four solid rocket boosters on the sides. It's similar to the shuttle design. The Energia was actually designed to carry the Russian Buran, which is in many ways more sophisticated than the shuttle. Yeah?
Following your mastery of the vomit throwing, how many times have you actually spewed in space?
Just... that's a genuine. So yet other things to do if you're stuck in space with a vacuum. Yeah?
What was the attitude of the other cosmonauts towards you initially? Obviously, you had
It varied tremendously from person to person. So it was quite daunting when I showed up in Dubai, and that the way I wanted to do it as a proper mission with experiments and by going through the full training, including learning Russian, that kind of made sense to the guys. So most of them, you know, became very good friends and colleagues. There were a couple of the older guys, particularly on the Russian side, who just found it very, very difficult, you know, to do. Not really. No, I wanted to do it as a South African citizen. I could have flown either as British or as South African. I'm dual citizenship, but I wanted to do it as a South African. You know, governments were Mandela, another one with Thabo Mbeki, and then some with different sort of South African people. It was really quite incredible once everything got together. But they had no hand in the actual setting up of it or the design of the missions and so on. Yeah. Different things stored, and the guys in, you know, on station then have to kind of balance that with making their own lives comfortable. So a lot of the stuff that goes on that doesn't get talked about is more in terms of just how they organize themselves and how they pack and store stuff, because it's just more efficient to do it. You know, they can see a more efficient way to do it than the ground controllers have necessarily thought of. There's quite a bit of it's amazing how what the mind can adjust to. You know, you somehow seem to forget that you're in a tin can 300 kilometers outside of the atmosphere doing Mach 25, where imminent death would take, you know, a small satellite in about 0.3 seconds. You just kind of adjust to this environment of, yeah, as you describe it, living in a bubble. And Soyuz is Moscow Standard Time. It's slightly tricky because the launch is governed by Kazakhstan time, the Soyuz flight is Moscow time, and the station is GMT. Yeah. The oxygen around you and wake up with some severe CO2 poisoning if you sleep in an area that's not well ventilated. So you generally tend to sort of strap yourself to the roof or the wall or the floor somewhere near one of the ventilation systems and just and sleep that way. Takes a little bit of getting used to. One of the difficult things with adjusting is your body is constantly pushing the blood vertically, right? Your arteries and your legs and the earth is just incredibly beautiful, and what's amazing about it is it seems to have so many different faces. You can fly over the same part of the Earth twice, two different times a day, and it looks quite different. So your first couple of days in space, you really don't want to sleep. But then you get into a fairly sort of regular rhythm. You know, it's lights out at around 11, and you get up at around 5.
We should probably stop there.
All set. Thank you. Thank you very much. What's that? Are you an organizer?
She's a helper.
What's that? Lying, cheating, dirty. Here we go. Who plays Mao? Right, you get it. Cheers, thanks.
Talk to you at some point, maybe tonight, about your school tool project.
Yeah, sure. We should chat now because I'm actually heading up to Sydney shortly.
Awesome. Okay.
What's up?
We're doing a whole bunch of stuff with WA, local and state government. Yeah. Kind of really enormous. There's a large point rollout wide area of the world. So that's currently a service for schools to use and provide basically, you know, those open environment for them. And then a good way for them to roll out.
So it seems that there's quite a lot of synergy. We're just transitioning schools to be Z3, so it really is a full Z3 component.
That's fine. That's what we're doing with a lot of our stuff too.
Totally focused on administration side of things, so not on the content management.
That's right.
Stuff. Just attendance, tests.
Yep.
What I urge you to do is get online and have a look at the state of
Tom Hoffman.
He's a project manager. He does a great job of kind of keeping everybody in the loop.
Yes.
Keeping the right guidance.
Mark, hi. Dave Kempy.
Nice to meet you.
Wars old boss. Long time ago. I'll give you my card. We're just looking to be a canonical support partner. We've just got this New South Wales government panel.
The contract's even not really existing yet.
James Person to kind of crystallise all of that.
We'll catch up next week.
Hi. I never realized, for example, how close Australia and the whole Indonesia is.
So is there anything particularly you want to say during the intro?
So what time do I want to end?
About 45 minutes after this, I believe.
Okay.
But what I'll do is I'll come down and I'll get front waving frantically and massively over, so I wouldn't stress you out.
Cool.
Yeah, so it's a 45 minute talk, so about 3:15. Cool. Should we get going? This is good.
Richard's fault. He came up with all the good ideas. I've just been doing a lot of the implementation for the last couple of years. And I think we'll have some fun things to talk about together. So I'd be glad to take questions at any point as we go along, so please feel free to interrupt me and whistle or something if I'm not noticing your hand up. To start off with, I've got a prem to the objective tool of truth, the Sucks Rules-O-Meter. And this is what we found on the Sucks Rules-O-Meter today. I searched this morning and I found 115 cases that 115 pieces of evidence that Linux printing actually does suck. Now we have to see how much Linux printing rules. And Linux printing rules, no doubt. Put them together in the text and strings, and you do your layout, and you format it up in some flavor that the printer is going to like it. And that's the rendering part of the problem. Once you have all that, you've got this format, you've got to actually find a printer, you've got to configure it, you've got to transfer your bits over the wire somehow. There's probably some system that queues it up, and eventually ink hits the paper. So we'll call that the plumbing part of the problem. This plumbing, so what, if we're going to make a rendering system to help address the suckiness of printing, what do we need to do? There's One of the most important things we need is the rendering model. We have to give an imaging model to the application designers that will let them draw. And the other requirement that's probably the primary requirement for printing is that what you see on the screen has to match what you get out the printer. And we've seen a lot of cases. Who's ever had a situation where they clicked the print button and got something totally ludicrous out that didn't match their screen at all?
Everyone's accepting things like the same PDF.
Yeah, well, yeah, accepting that. But you get is if there's a single interface that gets one piece of code draws to the screen and the same piece of code draws to the printer. If you don't have that, you're always going to have differences, and it's never going to work. So we need a unified API for both display and print. Okay, let's talk about what kinds of approaches have been looked at. Some things people have tried for the rendering X server or a separate X server that you connect to, and you talk the exact same protocol, but instead of displaying stuff on the screen, it prints for you. Seems like a good idea. You get that unified display print interface like we're talking about. Why is this a horrific idea that doesn't work? One of the big problems with XPrint is it's X. We finally recently got the replacement extension, the render extension. Before that, application authors had already given up on the rendering operations that X provides. You know, you've got these things like X, I don't remember, X draw arc or something. You've got these crazy... No, you didn't have, you didn't even have a spline. That was a call for a long time until the render extension. So XPrint still supports for printing that same old rendering model and these operators that no applications are using today. So the promise of XPrint, an XPrint proponent would say, well, it gives you this unified drawing API. And you say, well, I'm not using that API in the first place. So deliver on its promise. Okay, another more recent one is libgnomeprint. LibGnomePrint, as far as we've been talking about this, the rendering part of the problem and the plumbing part of the problem, LibGnomePrint sort of handles both of those. So some things, and a lot of the ways it deals with the plumbing part, are just fine. Those are perfectly adequate things that it does. One of the problems, though, is it gives a totally separate, the origin at the lower left and X to the right and Y going up. So you've already got an inverted coordinate system, and then the operations are totally different. You have PostScript-style operations in LibGnomePrint. So any application that wants to draw with X and wants to print with LibGnomePrint implements all the rendering code twice. Well, what happens when you write the code two different ways? Every other device we've been able to come up with so far. We have the ability to render on an OpenGL system. We can use Quartz on Mac OS X. Someone's even written a Win32 API for us, which didn't end up on the slide. I don't know why. So we have Win32 support, and you can also just have it render in software just to a memory buffer. You just have the model that Cairo provides. It borrows heavily from every successful imaging model we've seen so far. It uses a path-based model that will be familiar to anyone who's used PostScript before. You have operations that construct a path. You say move to, and then line to, and then curve to. So you've got these cubic Bezier splines, and that way you're sort of dragging a pen around to construct a path completely, which is how ink works on paper, and that's the idea. Well, okay, that's how some pigments work on paper. That was the philosophy behind that painter's model. It's called a painter's model. The metaphor is paint. It should be called a pigmenter's model or something. Okay, so Cairo goes beyond, it pulls over another. Over is one of the primary portedf operator it's used the most. But you've got several others as well. And so PDF, as of PDF 1.4, took the PostScript model and added portedf style compositing. It's a fundamental change in the imaging model, and it happened in this minor release. So I was so the way Cairo fits together, and I've got this stack here with Cairo is the second to the top, the applications above it, and we've got a fully connected graph here with all these other pieces. The idea is that Cairo doesn't try to completely wrap the font system, for example. Cairo does allow you, it can talk to the font system for you if you don't want to worry about the details, and you get sort of pretty lame subset. You can lay out text left to right or something like that. But if you want more details, you can actually go and ask the font system, okay, where are the fonts? List them for me. You can open the font file yourself, query the metrics yourself. This one. Here is a little demo application that Oyvind Kolas wrote for us. And up here at the top pane, we can see a little bit of Cairo code. And here in the lower right, you can see the results of that code. So, what's that? That's in C. Okay. There. But we have something I didn't have put a slide together. We have binding. In this example, we have a move to, and then a curve to, and stroke. So that's, we've moved to this point, we curved using this control point, that control point, and the end point, and you say stroke, and you get that result. Then these other ones, we have move to and line to, move to, line to, and stroke. That creates these two red lines. So that's, yeah, that top panel is the whole code to make that picture right there. It only takes about, you know, what is that, 10 to 15 lines of code, and you have this sort of cool-looking gradient. So if you look through that, what you do is you say, I want to create a linear gradient, and it goes from one point to another point, and then you add a couple of colors. So we say it's going to start out at the top. It's going to be white. It's going to go down to the operators, the image blending. We have the different caps, the different joins, the different caps. We can actually do text in here. There's some bugs. And we've just got bugs in there. So not done yet. Back to the slides. Okay, we saw some of that. Okay, now printing. We didn't have a lot of code yet, but we wanted to have something working right away. So what we did is we took the backend that draws an image into a memory buffer, and then we take that buffer, wrap it up in a PostScript header, and drop it out. And so you actually do get PostScript output, and you actually could print it. So from this first snapshot that we had of Cairo, you could actually... The benefit of this is that it let us skirt around the limitations of the PostScript rendering model. I mentioned earlier that PostScript doesn't have any support for alpha blending. All the paint is opaque. Well, we wanted to make graphics that had nifty alpha blending in them. Well, once we've rendered it to an image, we figured out all the final color values. We can spit that out in opaque. So the image isn't, since it's totally rasterized, it's not you can't manipulate it anymore. And the file sizes got kind of big. So it wasn't very nice to your I don't know, maybe the hard drive manufacturers would have liked it, but it really wasn't that too nice on system resources. So since then, we have a more real, it's like the alpha values and the gradients end up getting miscomputed or something like that. And I can show you some example. I've got, this is kind of funny. I'll show the example later after I've explained why the output will look funny. So we'll get that. So we've got an answer there. We still have this other PostScript backend. It's still in CVS and Metasurface. And the Metasurface will collect Cairo drawing operations in a logical form. So it would have all the vector information. And then when you've collected it all up and you say Cairo show page to ship it out to a page of PostScript, it's going to compute regions for objects that have some alpha. It's going to take the Metasurface and play it back using something very much like the current PDF backend, but instead spit out vectorized PostScript, and then take that region of rasterized stuff and just glob it on top. Now, when you're doing that, when you mix vector PDF or vector PostScript and this rasterized image on top, you can get some problems on scenes. For example, if we had an alpha blended rectangle. In addition to the PostScript, some people say, well, who cares about PostScript? I can just hand PDF to my printing system. We don't need to worry about that. This Metasurface will do a couple of other nice things for us. We can make the PDF backend implemented through a Metasurface, and it will only play it back to PDF at the end. What that will allow us to do is make that stored in a meta file and replay that meta file as OpenGL commands. So that'll be kind of cool. That'll be fun. And another thing that it will allow us to do is to create totally patterns that are defined logically. Right now we have a pattern interface where you can construct, well, for example, you saw those, you saw the gradients. The gradients are transformation, rotation, scaling, and always get the good results. So that'll be fun. Hope to finish that. Hope to have some time to work on that this summer. Okay. What's happening with Cairo? People are starting to play with it. We haven't had a 1.0 release yet, We're looking to do that in the next couple of months, trying to beat the next GDK release. GDK, as of CVS right now, depends on Cairo. So the next major release of GDKS that uses Cairo, I don't think any of these are using Cairo by default because it's still a little bit slow. Mozilla's kind of interesting. It has been for a while. There's been support to do the SVG rendering. If you configure in the SVG support for Cairo, for Mozilla, you can choose from several different backends. One of them is Cairo. But as of what are we doing with Cairo right now? We're in the middle, like I said, we're getting ready for our 1.0 release. And before we did that, we wanted to take a really good look at the API and make sure it was everything we wanted. So in February at Linux World, we got, I guess, the initial group of the Cairo Architecture Committee or something. Anyone who cared about it got together in Boston, and we stayed up all night. So I tried to not put anything into the API that would expose the fact that I know nothing about color. The plan we have to support color management systems is that the color management system would happen on one of those layers just above Cairo in that architecture I have. In order to make that possible, we are exporting an sRGB interface, but an sRGB interface that would, because that doesn't really fit into that system. If you're using a spot color, you have a named color. It might correspond to a special ink cartridge in your inkjet printer that is the color of your logo. So there's no computational value for this thing. It is just the name. One way an application could do spot colors is to just make a separate surface, and I'm kind of bored with that. So this weekend, I think I'm going to commit everything that every application will break, and no program that's ever been written using Cairo will work anymore, and that's going to be kind of fun. So I think I'm going to do it right before I get on the plane for 25 hours, too. What's that? Threads? No threads. No threads in Cairo. So, but no, this is a fun way to be evil. And slack there is to improve the performance. I mean, it's going to get so much better. That's a positive thing. We get to improve a lot. Performance isn't fantastic right now. The code hasn't been optimized. And there's three basic layers that happen in the imaging. You specify your path. You say stroke or fill. And so that tessellation algorithm right now isn't numerically robust, and it's totally of the wrong complexity. It's probably cubic when it's supposed to be n log n. So in the common case. So we're going to fix that. The funny thing is that's never shown up on the profiles because the second and third stages are so slow. How much coverage there is. We used to try to do that analytically. Realize that doesn't work, and it's not any better than just putting a sample point grid in there and counting up some number of sample points. So we've rewritten it that way, and we have some very simple code that Keith wrote in one evening?
An hour.
So our current tests library, and if you have a sufficiently well-accelerated OpenGL implementation, the compositing part's really fast. If you have an ATI graphics card and you use Keith's fancy XATI K-Drive server, the compositing is really fast. Eric Anholt did some work to do that. So that part's, that part's not my expertise. I'll let other people make that game. It's Ian McIntosh. And he says, oh, we've got a question over here. That image with all the layers and a fully connected graph, if you need to reach down and ask your printer to get its color profile and ask about the device color, you should be able to do that. And there's other libraries, there's little CMS that helps with some parts of this problem. What's that? Yeah, well, color management is a really complex system-wide. Excellent.
But it doesn't actually do any computation or
impulse. Okay. So back to Linux World, Boss hard drive. So you could actually use this thing in the car away from the network. And it was laying out the text, wrapping the text along the roads,
And it was this beautiful little thing. And I said, this is fantastic. Where's the code? He's like, oh, I haven't published it or anything yet. It was just on his hard drive. And I said, Ian, we need this code. So I gave him commit access on the spot. We had a better answer for data. But it says, the U.S. Census Bureau has data available at the following website. It gives a URL. I clicked on it. There were the files. I downloaded them. The next dialogue, I pointed Roadster at these compressed files. It imported them. I said, this is an application that's not been polished. It was amazing. So it was. It's been a lot of fun. There are some performance really slow. So it's not going to be this snappy as maps.google.com, but hopefully it'll look as good. And here's Roadster sitting inside GDB. So I don't think I'll demo that version. Let's see if we can get one that's actually running. So it starts up viewing nothing. So right now it knows how to import Tiger data, which is what the U.S. Census Bureau supports. Ian said he'd be glad to write code to import any other data if someone has data.
There's a whole bunch of vector transfer standards that are firming up now, so there'll be a lot.
Yeah, Ian has a lot of crazy ideas for this. I mean, one of the things it doesn't do yet is it can't compute driving directions for you. And one of the things that's difficult about that is that the U.S. Census Bureau data doesn't have any detailed information on directionality. So you don't know where the one-way streets are, for example. So it'd be kind of dangerous to actually compute driving direction as it continues to draw every road and compute a lot. It's probably computing and drawing text that's microscopic and you can't even see it. But it sort of gives you some idea of what you can do. And what I really wanted to show was the whole point of my talk here is that, so now we're starting to see quite a little bit of data. We can almost see Keith's house on there now. I wasn't just procrastinating my talk, I was imposing it was a self-imposed time restriction. What I wanted to do was to demonstrate that I could hack Roadster in one night and add PDF export. So I did a couple nights ago. I wrote sort of a 10-line function. So it's probably more interesting to look at the code than to watch it try to run because it doesn't run right now. But so there's a point in these different roads and maps. Didn't change. I didn't have to touch any of that. And I should be able to get PDF files. But if I run it, it crashes, and I don't know why. And that's really sad. But I can show some PDF. I'm getting bad feedback.